What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello and welcome to this very special interview where I am joined by Stephen Carson, otherwise known as Radcliffe. How are you, sir?
Very good.
Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's an honor and a pleasure. Well, for anyone who doesn't know, we recorded the breakfast show this morning.
And we talked about the early church.
A little bit.
It's been a while, but
Our original conversation like three years ago or something.
Yeah, it's been years.
Yeah. But that was a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
I'd like to do it again, actually, pick your brain more.
Right.
I find late antiquity or the early Christian period absolutely fascinating.
I quickly took it until I was out of my depth. If it came to anything with Roman emperors and stuff like that, you were killing me.
No, it's fascinating. There was loads of things in there you said that I didn't know. So
yeah.
No, great stuff. Okay, so today though,
right,
we thought we'd talk about something completely different.
Yeah.
We thought we'd talk about, mutual aid societies, the history and what they are, what they mean, what they could mean going forward and everything. And so it's a little bit of a speciality of yours, if you want to tell us about that.
There's two things coming into this that I have behind me coming into this. One is that I did a series on my channel, Radical Liberation, on YouTube, on mutual aid societies, where I went through a book by David Bateau. And he was focused more on the American side, but it's kind of a very similar story in the UK, for example. And so I just went through that book because I wanted to understand this history. And then I helped actually form one. I helped form a brotherhood.
In real life?
The Old Glory Club.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah, so I
was the first president
right.
of the Old Glory Club. And I continue to be on the national organization. And we now have chapters in most states. So it's actually going quite
really?
Well.
Is it that big?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize it was that big.
It's happening.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Wow. That's
sometimes
incredible.
Sometimes multiple.
Well done.
Sometimes multiple chapters. Yeah.
Well done. Then.
Well, it's all of us. It's not just me. That's right. For sure.
Yeah.
We have a great president now. So I've got that in my background. And then the Islander asked me to submit something. And I thought, well, this is an easy topic to talk about. I'm doing it. And then I did this whole series on the history of it. And so I just submitted a draft to them, and hopefully we'll see that in an upcoming issue of The Islander. And my proposed title, editors like to change titles, my proposed title is Brotherhoods, because that's really what struck me, learning about mutual aid societies. They're fraternal societies, brotherly societies, right? And that is the theme that you see running through it. It's about, how do you put it? Extending the bonds that we usually think of as family bonds, right? Like you've got your cousins and your uncles and your brothers. With a fraternal society, you stretch that out just a little to include some like-minded men who are maybe your neighbors or neighbors to you in another sense, right? With Lotus Eaters, a lot of us feel very close to each other because we sort of ideologically have a lot in common, right? Well, these mutual aid societies, you might work in a similar industry. You might all be Catholic. You might all be of a similar ethnic background. Like you were all immigrants from Ireland to the United States. And so you work with fellow Irish immigrants to support each other when hard times come. So, but the theme is extending that brotherhood. And so in the Old Glory Club, for instance, we refer to each other as brothers. Right. And when Central is coming, when the national organization is coming down on someone, they'll say things like, you don't talk that way to your brother. We understand you disagree, but find a way to express it that's respectful.
Right.
Right. So there's that emphasis on a fraternal kind of relationship.
It's funny, and I'm only joking here, but often brothers are the most brutal to each other. I'm joking. I'm just joking.
No, no. actually, I think that's one of the things that I'm seeing as we work, as we do this in real life, is that you get a track record with people. When you really start cooperating together to do things, you start to learn who you can trust, who's reliable, who does what they say, right?
Yeah,
who's petty and bickering, you know?
Sometimes
we don't like that kind of behavior.
Sometimes your worst enemy is your brother or your own father. It's never the case in my family. But sometimes, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, anyway, that's an aside. That's a complete an aside. So before we dig into sort of some of the real minutiae of sort of the rise and fall, the nature of mutual aid societies and brotherhoods and sort of the more 19th century thing and all sorts of examples of the exclusionary nature of it and all that sort of thing. I wonder if I could just ask you a question or two about sort of in the broadest sense about it. Because one of the things that struck me when I was reading your article, so I've read your
draft,
was something that Marx talked about. Now, you and I are both the furthest thing from Marxists, so...
We can learn from anyone.
Yeah. This isn't me saying, Marx said a brilliant thing I agree with. I'm not doing that.
Right.
But Marx talks about, or he's not the only one to have done so, but talks about sort of the atomization and alienation. And in Marx's view, a lot of that was connected specifically to capitalism. But anyway.
And
the idea that today in the 2020s in the West, in places like the United States and Great Britain, that lots and lots of people, particularly young men, but anyone really, that sense of loneliness, isolation, the atomization of society, even family units. And whether in the Marxist view or not, that's got anything to do with capitalism is something else. But it's something that ever since, I think, since the Industrial Revolution, I think for a good couple of hundred years now or more, that's just increasing. And if anything, if anything, I feel like even with the internet, it's still increasing, still quickening, going ever faster, if anything.
So some people would say in part because of the internet.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
You think you've got lots and lots of online friends, but actually, physically, you're sitting in a room on your own for most of your life.
Right.
And so that I feel that there is a market for some sort of real life brotherhood.
Yeah.
Whether you want to call them mutual aid societies, that's quite a 19th century, early 20th century way of phrasing it, but something.
Something, yeah, yeah. Right. So I'm going to use some language I learned from my wife, who's a therapist.
Okay.
Right? So psychological language for a moment.
Okay.
But it just really has to do with how humans function as mammals. We need bonds.
We're a pack animal.
Yes, we need connection with other humans. You might know that it's considered a form of torture, and it's supposedly not allowed, though people do it anyway, to have someone in solitary confinement for long periods of time, because you just can start going loopy without connection to other
nearly
people.
Most people would, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's the failure to thrive thing that happened. I think it was after World War II, a lot of orphan babies, you know, very few care workers to take care of them. They're feeding them, they're changing their diaper, and they're dying. And they're like, what in the world's going on? Finally, they ask some volunteers to come in and just hold the babies. And they stop dying. Because we need connection. We need bonds. And what you're talking about is a very frightening development. My wife and I are very concerned about the lack of family formation, namely people getting married or coupling. I don't care if it's a state-ordained marriage. The point is coming together, having kids, building a family. We're seeing a lack of that. And even, and I think this is particularly hard for young men, sometimes they just don't have friends. They just don't have mates, right? So this is bad. So that's part of the reason I'm passionate about this topic, because there's a real felt need. And unlike some of the crazier utopian ideas that intellectuals like us like to talk about, mutual aid societies is really grounded in the history of our people. And it's not even like, you know, 1,000 years ago in the Middle Ages, people used to do this. No, like our great grandparents would have been in mutual aid societies. This isn't that long ago. It was actually quite strong, maybe at its strongest in the early 20th century. And it's only as you get into like the mid 20th century that you start to see a real drop off in participation. Many of these societies are still around, but there's just kind of like a lot of old people in them and they're going to just disappear. Right. And so that's in part why we founded a new one rather than joining an old one. We wanted to just start with some youthful energy and kind of revive this structure. There's nothing wrong with it, really. The welfare state competed with some of the functions of the mutual aid societies, which would be sort of like insurance and funeral expenses. And they'd help you with things like that. Right. And as the state took over some of those functions, that leached away some of sort of the practical reasons people would form these. But now, you know, 100 years later, whatever, of or more of doing the welfare state, we all know that it isn't all that was promised, right? It doesn't really work as well as we hoped. And it's really like an acid to bonds. It really breaks families apart. It breaks communities apart.
On the welfare state.
Say again?
The welfare state.
The welfare state. Yeah. So keeping it on the family level, on that micro level, for example, at one time, part of the reason that sort of a practical reason to have children, to keep good relations with them, is they're going to be the ones taking care of you when you're old. Mm-hmm. Well, now the boomers famously just go on cruises somehow constantly and screw the next generation, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that intergenerational dependency. You know, I take care of you when you're a kid. You take care of me when you're old. Honor thy father and mother, right? That was broken by the welfare state. Mm. But I think a lot of us can see that that was bad. And so I think people are really, it's a great time to be looking at this again. Because whatever temporary high that people had about the welfare state, I think that's long gone. Mm. And now people can see, maybe we should try some of the older ways again.
And the idea that the state will see you through from cradle to grave.
Yes.
Is that ideal? Is that actually good?
Right.
Quite possibly not.
And is it the adult version? Do you end up with sort of the adult version of failure to thrive? Yes. The state gives me money and it educates my children and everything. But I don't feel connected. I don't feel bonded. Right. I don't feel part of a community.
Mm. Yeah, right? Yeah. May not even have any friends. So yeah. Before we get on to, because I wanted to mention the Mark Houghton and the basket weavers and a similar sort of thing. But let's go back to the beginning, because the welfare state is a modern, very modern thing. I mean,
the Kaiser or whatever brought it in, right?
Kaiser Wilhelm, like the Krupp industry and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like second half of the 19th century. Even. Yeah. Not even the first half. So it's really, historically speaking, it's a blink of an eye that we've had the welfare state.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we already can see, maybe that wasn't such a great idea.
So the vast majority of human civilization, there was nothing like the welfare state. So you mentioned, and I know a tiny bit about it myself, that even if you go back to the earliest possible seeds of it, you might say are in England, in this, like the 17th century.
Right.
Something like that.
And I don't know much about that very, very early history, but that's when you first start seeing them forming friendly societies.
So the idea that some people, well, you might want to call it philanthropy, maybe, maybe not, but some people see, some men see a need for, some sort of wider society where they can look after each other.
Yes.
It's quite as simple as that, isn't it, really, in the first instance? Some or one of us fall on hard times,
right,
we've all paid into a pot and we might be able to help each other out.
Yeah. And
simple as that, really.
My profession is IT, tech. So forgive the tech term here, but peer-to-peer.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
As opposed to a hierarchical. That's what the Mutual Aid Society is focused on. We're not going to have some like rich guy and he's going to take care of us. We're going to pool our resources, not just money, but time and so forth, right? Mm. And we are going to support each other. Right. So when you're having some bad fortune hit your life, your brothers will be there for you, and then you'll be there for us.
So the state's got nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
It's just like-minded just fellow men, brothers.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was really quite exclusionary. Not anyone could join. That's the whole point of it, is that you need to be able to rely on them, not to be a complete drain on it, to be trustworthy,
yes,
and all those things. So it's not for everyone.
Well, let's put it this way. There, in any given brotherhood, in any given fraternal organization, there would be, historically, there was some kind of exclusionary mechanism. Mm-hmm. And it, as I mentioned, it could be religious, ethnic, all kinds of things.
Mm. Anything they want. Anything profession. That brotherhood wants. Right?
Yeah, profession or whatever, or some combination of it. But what was the practical reason, going into sort of social theory a little bit here? The practical reason is that you need to have a little high trust society, right?
Right.
That's what the fraternal...
In microcosm.
Yeah, fraternal society is a little micro high trust society. How do you have a high trust society? Well, we now know from Robert Putnam and various work on this in sociology that diversity actually reduces trust in a society.
Of course it does.
I know. Only here on Lotus Eaters can I say this without anyone blinking an eye. You know?
Of course it does.
We know this. Yeah.
Homogeneity is...
Let me get into the mechanics of it. Okay. Because I think thinking about mutual aid societies helps us understand this sort of diversity versus homogeneity thing. Why is homogeneity helpful? It's because of you need to be able to like understand each other, right? You need to understand that when someone says something, what it means, what kind of obligations have been created, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about different cultures is that they have different ways that those things function. Mm-hmm. They all have ways to do it, but they don't necessarily mesh with each other well across those cultures,
Yeah.
So within a culture, you need to, a fraternal society is going to pick a culture, even kind of a sub-slice of a culture, right? Just English plumbers or Welsh plumbers or something, right? And such that everybody in there is speaking the same language, culturally speaking, right? Has similar expectations, right? You know, the old English phrase, well, that just isn't done, right? Well, what isn't done? Depends. Depends on your religion, depends on your cultural background, your history, right? All of these things change, give you a different idea of what is acceptable and what is not. So it's really hard, basically impossible, to form a fraternal society with people who have radically different expectations along those lines. You need to have people who just kind of get it implicitly, tacit knowledge. They just implicitly understand, oh, this is what we're doing. These are the kinds of expectations that are going to be on me and that I can have on other people. This is the kind of commitment I'm making. And you have to have something more than, this is not piece of paper stuff, right? You have to have personal bonds. You feel loyal to each other. One of the things we found, actually with the Skildings conference is where it really blew my mind. The first time I went to a Skildings conference, a lot of these people I had known online, okay? And and we, you know, online is you bicker with each other online. It's just what you do. And so I wondered what it would be like to get in person together. I thought, oh, we'll just all be like bickering, and it'll be kind of Reddit Spurgout time or whatever. Well, it wasn't that way at all. Because once we got together in person, we saw that we were very like-minded. And that the little things that we like to argue about online are like 0.001% of what matters. We immediately felt, just meeting, it became more real, that we had a real connection, a real bond, a real like-mindedness, and that's where the Old Glory Club came from, right? We met each other and we're like, oh, we can build something with a set of men like us that are just, you know, we have that homogeneity, right? We have these shared values, and we just trust each other. You know?
I think perhaps trust is sort of the key thing, the absolute key thing.
Absolutely.
And this, I think this goes back through probably all of human civilization.
Yeah.
That you need to be able to trust the other members of your tribe, whether that is just simply your family unit or something much bigger than that.
Yeah.
But let's use the word tribe in a very, very broad sense.
Yeah.
That we're of the same tribe.
Right.
Whether it's Welsh plumbers.
Yeah,
or something much broader than that, or something even more specific than
or
that.
Or the early church, you know.
Yeah.
All we have in common is that we've accepted Jesus, right?
Yeah.
But we trust each other because of that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And many groups do this just implicitly already, right?
Yeah,
it's something that I think maybe...
It's very normal.
Yeah, very, very normal.
Very human
right.
and normal.
Yeah. And that it's something that somehow, whether the welfare states are... massive part of it or not, I imagine it is, but somehow in the Anglosphere, in the West, over the last century or more, we've lost that.
Yeah.
That a lot of people in the West these days have got an out-group preference, if anything.
Right.
Like what a perverse thing that is to discover.
Yeah, and so we're having to, this is kind of an awkward phrase, reinvent social technology, you know, or rediscover social technology. how did we have high trust societies in the past? How were we able to do the things we were able to do and cooperate in the way we were able to cooperate? Because now it seems very difficult to just be able to trust other people enough to make long-term commitments, right? You've got to have trust to have a long-term commitment.
Yeah.
Right.
I had a conversation with Professor Ed Dutton not too long ago. He was talking all about the Quakers, obviously, and what a particular Christian sect. But how sort of tightly knit they are, and going back through to the 17th century, all through the 18th and 19th and 20th century, how they could implicitly trust each other because they're just Quakers. And that's it. That's it. You know that you can trust them with something, with money, with secrets, whatever it is. And there's many, 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 many examples of that in. But it seems that, like, the Anglosphere, something like that, so we've lost something, lost somewhere along the way, somehow lost that sort of, that trust.
I would sound slightly conspiratorial and say it's actually been attacked.
No.
Our ability to trust each other.
I absolutely believe it. Yeah, very, very deliberately undermined.
Deliberately undermined.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. I believe that.
Right. And so the point of me bringing up this history of mutual aid societies is to say, number one, our great grandparents did it. This isn't even that long ago. And why not do it again?
What's stopping us?
Nothing's stopping us.
Right.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, the Old Glory Club, for example, is not a political organization. I mean, we help in when there's disaster relief. We help a brother who has lost a job.
Mm.
You know, I mean, we go to a historical event. You know, it's the Gettysburg, Battle of Gettysburg commemoration. And we go to the battlefield, or the brothers who are in that area join together and go to the battlefield and learn more about their own history.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
You'd love those history tours.
Yeah.
We do. Yeah.
I say what's stopping us.
Yeah.
Much less stopping us in the United States. In Britain, we do have, or in Europe, certainly in Britain, we do have, like, equality legislation, where if you said, I want to form a society, a group, however you want to call it, a brotherhood, a formal organisation where people, and there's money involved, people are paying into it, and it's going to be only Englishmen from the Southwest, and they must be white, and they must be Protestant. Let's just say that, just random set of things.
Sure.
You're not allowed to do that. You have to let women and people of colour into it. You have to. Otherwise, it's illegal. The police will come around and knock on your door and say, you're not allowed to do this.
Maybe. Now, I'm not a lawyer. Don't take my advice. I kind of thought that was true in the United States because we have a lot of the similar kind of legislation along those lines, right? But actually, it's not.
Oh, okay.
It depends on what you're doing. Okay. If you're running a for-profit business, you can run into that.
Okay.
But nonprofits actually can have a lot of lot of latitude. Okay. So there might be more latitude than you'd guess.
Okay. Maybe we should look into that.
Yeah, that's the point of me bringing it up.
Just while we're on exploring this vein, maybe it's the moment to just mention the basket weavers.
Yes.
And there's something like that. So you're aware. I asked you this morning if you're aware of them, and you said, of course I am. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was doing it. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So what was your experience with that, and how did you...
Yeah, well, this was academic agent's suggestion originally. He said, you know, we can't just be online all the time. There's something missing. We need to meet together in real life. And he says, I don't care what you do. Just get together. Weave baskets. So jokingly, they called it the basket weavers, right? What do basket weavers do in practice? In a local area, they get together and they go on a hike or whatever.
Yeah.
Kind of the local, and this is the true of our chapters in the OGC as well. It's really up to the local area, the members in the local area, kind of to decide what they want to make of it. Is this going to be kind of a regular game night that we get together and do board games?
A drink?
Or are we just going to have a pint together? Different people do different things or do a variety of things depending on what they feel like. That's fine, right? The point is, you're meeting together in real life. You're having the opportunity to form bonds, trust, loyalty. And that means that when something comes along that you didn't expect, you can think of somebody to call that you don't feel awkward about calling.
Right.
Of course it's okay to call these people. They know me.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah.
And they'll help me out with whatever this is.
There's no substitute for that.
Exactly.
I've always been lucky where I've never found myself in a place in my life where I was truly isolated.
Oh, good.
Where I truly never had any friends whatsoever.
Right.
But I can only imagine that would be horrible. That would be terrifying. Yeah. If there was no one to turn to, literally no one at all.
Yeah, because things happen.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
life. Things happen that you don't expect.
And the state, for whatever reason, just says, no, you're on your own.
Yeah.
So that's a dead end.
Right.
You might not have family. Like, you might not have a benevolent father or an older brother that's able to help you out or whatever. You haven't got any of that. And you haven't got any friends. Certainly not no staunch friends that you genuinely love and trust.
Right.
And they die for you and you die for them. You haven't got anyone like that in your life.
Yeah.
That would be really terrible.
It's a bad situation to be in.
Yeah. Really, right. I mean, that is sort of like the true atomization of that person almost.
Right.
So to do anything, to even begin to address that, because I think it's not an isolated few people that applies to. I think that might be millions of people in the world that applies to.
And let me be clear. I'm not bringing up mutual aid societies because I think like that solves all our problems. I'm saying it's a piece.
Sure.
It's a piece of the puzzle.
Sure.
You know, as a Christian, I would encourage people to become Christians and go to church. Well, that's another place to form bonds, right? But I think we need to try a number of different, we need to bring back, not just try, we need to bring back a number of practices that we as European people did for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, right? Mm. There were the guilds, so professional organizations, right? There were the mutual aid societies, there were parishes and parish activities, on and on and on, right? Mm. We had many, many, so, you know, one person would be, you know, just a member of, you know, their mutual aid society, but in their professional organization, they're like a leader in it. Right? And so forth, right? So one person would have this very complicated relationship to the world around them where they're hierarchically sort of higher and lower depending on what it is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's beautiful. That's how it should be.
Right. Yeah, nice. So it got to quite a sophisticated level. For example, very near here, 5-minute walk from here, there's a whole bunch of houses that are just known as the Railway Village. And where we had the British Rail, or the beginnings of the railways in Britain, again, long before the welfare state or anything like that, you'd have people that worked for the railways. They would all join together in what was essentially some sort of mutual aid society.
Oh.
And it was just for people that worked in the railways, on the railways. And Swindon used to be a giant hub, or the hub for the southwest of all of England, where lots and lots of trains got actually built. There's a big thing. And so there's so many workers there that they built their own village, essentially.
Right.
But then on top of that, they built like their own swimming pool. Mm-hmm. They built their own basically like a hospital. And it was just for the people that worked in the railway, on the railways.
Yeah, and you're saying this wasn't the company building the swimming pool. This was the workers pooling together and saying, hey, we'd like a swimming pool. Well, let's do it. Right?
And it wasn't the state.
Yeah. Right.
It wasn't the state.
Yeah.
Okay. And so they built basically what is a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But out of that, over 150 years or more, out of that, you end up with a giant welfare state, the NHS, which costs billions a week. And everyone's involved in it. Like literally everyone has to pay a tax that goes towards it all the time. Yeah. Anyone that comes over gets any free healthcare at the point of... So it's from that tiny sort of noble, righteous, beautiful, really, beginning, we've now got this giant, insane monster of a thing in the modern NHS, which is not fit for purpose. It's broken. It's bankrupting the state. It's so over the top, so crazy. It's like this monster that has grown out of it. But the original thing, that 19th century thing, where it was just mutual aid between a set of railway workers.
Yeah.
That was something.
Nothing's wrong with that.
Right. There was nothing wrong with
very
that.
Very good thing. Beautiful thing.
Yeah. It worked.
Yeah.
It works so much better than this socialist nightmare. Something Clement Attlee brought in the late 40s. Again, probably would have been coming from a good place in his heart, I imagine, but is now utterly out of control.
Right. Yeah, so here's, let me draw an analogy from economics. Okay, so, you know, money was not originated by the state. That's my view. Okay. With some backing.
Money?
Yeah, the money.
All money. You're going just back to the ancient
world. The idea of using money.
Okay.
Right? I mean, it's just, it's a something that naturally arises, right? And it serves a useful function, you know, a means of exchange that is widely accepted, right? So you have this thing that's there, that's valuable, that serves a socially useful purpose. And eventually the king gets involved, right? And he puts his name on it, or the emperor, or whatever, stamps his face on it. And then he starts shaving bits off the coin, right? And then you get the ridges on the coin, right? And all that. the point is, you have these socially useful, healthy things that someone will parasitically latch onto and twist it out of all recognition, right? So that is my view on what you're describing. And indeed, as I wrote about, the mutual aid societies very often would like start hospitals, sanitariums, whatever those were, health resorts, I guess.
For mentally ill people. Orphanages.
Orphanages.
All sorts of things, right?
Yeah. They would just see a need of their members. Hey, we've got some members who died. What do we do with the kids? They don't really have relatives to take them in.
Your burials and things.
And so they'd, say, form an orphanage. And then once it was there, maybe some other people would benefit from it who aren't members of the society, right? You know, once this structure is there, it could have wider benefits, which to my view is all good, right? That the problem is when you undermine what built it all in the first place. You abolish the ability to exclude. And so now you have people come along who are not participating in the give and take that a mutual aid society does. Mm. They're just takers.
Right.
And it's not going to last when you get that.
That's not sustainable, is it?
It's not sustainable.
So that is a key element of it.
Very briefly, very briefly, the thing that got built, you can kind of leech off that for a little while, for a generation maybe even, right? Generation or two. And it seems like you're getting things for free. But actually, you're eating away at the foundation of what built this beautiful thing in the first place. And soon enough, it'll just start collapsing on you.
So that is really a key. We mentioned it earlier, but that really is an absolutely fundamental element of it, is the exclusionary nature of it.
Yeah.
Is that it's not for everyone, that you want to be very, very careful before you let anyone in a mutual aid society or a brotherhood, whatever you want to call it. Be extremely careful that you're not letting in someone who's there in bad faith.
That's right.
That they're looking just to leech from it. They're looking for free gibs. Right.
Yeah.
That's
not a brother.
Right.
Right.
And so that would have to be done to be, you can never really know people, can you? But still, you'd have to be relatively, well, you'd have to be very careful about who you don't let in. It's certainly not just a blanket, anyone that's of this age or anyone that lives here.
Yeah. No.
That doesn't work.
No. In fact, the mutual aid societies, I mentioned some of the exclusionary, like you would just have to be in a certain profession or whatever, right? But then that wasn't the only requirements. After you met those requirements, they would interview you, maybe interview people who knew you, right? To vet for character, for reliability, that you're not an addict who is just going to come in and destroy everything, right? And then even once a member, you could get kicked out for bad behavior. Someone would say, use the mutual aid for some sick benefits. Hey, I got really sick. I couldn't work for a couple weeks. We're right on the edge. My family needs some help. They'd say, great, we're happy to help. We're going to come and check on you, make sure everything's okay and you're really sick.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, it's trust but verify.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, it's a mutual aid society that's to do with health. And we just need to check that you're not a sexual degenerate and have got late stage syphilis.
Yes.
Before we let you in.
That is just one of the specific things that I found in the research. They would talk about how it was interesting. They'd become requirements, but they also became something that they would encourage. Once you join the mutual aid society, they would encourage thrift and good character and all these kinds of sexually good behavior, right? Mm-hmm. Because when people do these things that in the old days we would have called sinful, they have practical effects in real life, right? In particular, you end up getting somebody who's drawing too much, taking more than giving, because they're living an irresolute life, as they used to say.
And these sorts of things only work if there's a small number of those. Well, you want the absolute minimum number of those, right?
Yeah, right.
And so, again, that leads us on to sort of the modern 2020s welfare state, where you've got millions and millions of people that are just simply leeching off of it.
Yeah.
And that we're supposed to accept that that's okay, and in fact can increase indefinitely, that somehow that's sustainable, that somehow that's good for anyone. But we are supposed to accept that, aren't we? If, especially if you're of the left.
Right.
You're supposed to accept that everyone, there's no upper limit to the number of people that can be on welfare, or there's no upper limit to the welfare bill, because it's just the morally correct thing to do.
Right.
Well, be that as it may, I don't accept that anyway, but even if you did accept that, well, the numbers just simply won't add up.
Eventually reality
quite
sets
quickly.
In. Yeah. We were just doing the breakfast show together this morning, and there was that number of the number of people living off, just completely living off of the state, and it was like 600,000 people or
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it never occurred to me until you just said this. You would think in the legislation, they would put some kind of cap, maybe not a number, but a percentage, you know, only a certain percent of people can be just fully reliant on this, because we know that if that percentage creeps up too much, the whole system will fall apart. Well, you never see that. Yeah. Have you ever even heard of the idea of a cap like that?
No, they won't have
it. No one's ever talked about it.
Like the left, the soft left, or I suppose maybe because you get even conservatives, mostly in Britain and the United States, conservatives with a small C, whether it's whatever it is. But a lot of them seem to have accepted lots and lots of leftist paradigms, basically, like there is no upper limit to that. Or the idea that the state is going to pay this bill for welfare, and when the numbers don't make sense anymore, don't add up anymore, the state is then going to borrow money from international bond markets or something, going to borrow it from the World Bank in order to keep paying for this.
Right. So, just use your magic wand, please.
You're just living in an insane world. You're living in La La Land at that point. It's not...
And as you're talking about this, it brings to mind something I learned from Professor Don Livingston, who talks about, he's a philosopher, he talks about scale. That's something that in political philosophy we don't tend to talk much in modern times. Human scale versus the kind of scale that modern welfare states are on. People just don't flourish in that kind of beyond human scale sorts of institutions, right? He points out that the places where we've had great cultural flourishings, like Florence in a certain area, and in a certain era, Venice in a certain era, they were big enough. They weren't little. They weren't villages. They were proper cities, right? So it was big enough to support painters and people like this, right? But also, like, all the painters in town knew each other, right? It wasn't on some gargantuan Manhattanite scale. It was human enough scale that you actually could be in connection and conversation with other people in that city, right? And he says that's really, and he also talks about ancient Greece, the city-states of Greece, right? That's the scale at which we really see wonderful things happen culturally, right? And so in a similar way, the modern welfare state, all the other things we said about being true, it's just too big. It's just too big.
Just simple as that, right?
Yeah, humans don't work well in that way. You end up with the Kafka-esque experience where you're calling and you're in the phone tree and you can't get to a human. And this is the only way you have now, because they've destroyed all the other structures. This is the only way you have to get your medical needs met. And you can't find your way through the damn impersonal bureaucratic system, right?
It's a
horrible way to live.
Yeah, it is. Do you know what you made me think of when you talk about that in Florence?
Yeah.
There's a great, I mentioned it from time to time, there's a great late 1960s documentary, Civilization, by the historian, art historian Kenneth Clark. He talks about a fascinating thing. He talks about when you look at the grand monumental architecture of the 12th, 13th century, giant cathedrals. You go in there and it's a giant open space. It's meant to dominate you. It's meant to make you feel small, meant to remind you of the scarcely imaginable grandeur of the church and heaven and God and all that sort
right.
of thing.
Right.
But it was stupefying to the society. Mm-hmm. Then you look at, say, Florence at the very beginning of the Renaissance, sort of the 15th century, the early 15th century. Suddenly you find in Florence, they're very deliberately building ornate buildings on a human scale.
Mm.
Suddenly the scale of humanity itself is taken into account. And you go into certain rooms and the scale of it isn't designed to overwhelm you.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't designed to do that. It's designed to nurture you as a human.
Right.
As a human, to speak to you on a human scale, in a human way. And what did you get? You got a rebirth of classicism. You got an explosion of thoughts and ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these people that's got a problem with the Enlightenment in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that just in it's just interesting that you mentioned Florence and things being on the human scale.
Yeah.
That you can have things that are institutions, whether it's architecture or institutions, that are too big.
Yeah.
And they don't work. They don't serve the purpose anymore. They don't
right.
help humans and humanity. In fact, they're a detriment to them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it just sparked a thought in my mind. When you said
yeah.
That.
So bringing it back to mutual aid societies.
Mm.
Yes, mutual aid societies would often develop chapters and they might spread from town to town depending on the success of the mutual aid society, whether it was run well and grew and all that. But even when that happened, and there were benefits to that, your experience of the mutual aid society would be small and local.
Mm, sure.
It'd be your local chapter or lodge. They often would call them lodges. Your local lodge or chapter, whatever they called it, would be enough a small enough number of people that you knew them.
Mm-hmm.
You knew these people. You hung out. You did social events together.
Mm.
You did charitable efforts together. Hey, there's some flooding. Let's go help out. You guys all go work and do sandbagging, because the river ran over the, right? And so you're working alongside each other, which means building bonds. Hey, this is a guy you can count on.
Mm.
We kept going into the night together on that, or whatever.
Not only did you have shared values, but you had shared goals,
yeah.
right? You're working towards the same, trying to pull in the same direction,
yes.
towards whatever it was.
Right.
Whether it's helping in a flood disaster or just seeing that the local orphans don't just starve to death or die of exposure.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the last things then to say, before I get onto the last thing I want to say,
yeah.
just want a quick word about secret societies though.
Yeah. And I did
the
not
idea
dig...
that a lot of people are deep, for example, very, very
I did not
deeply,
dig
suspicion
deeply into those.
Of like the Masons, right? A lot of mm-hmm. people are deeply, deeply suspicious of the Masons. Some people might listen to the conversation we just had and think, they mm-hmm. might think, we're talking about Freemasonry. That's
right.
not a good idea. I don't like that. I hate that. That's evil. Da-da-da-da. But
no.
That's not what we're talking about, right?
No, and obviously Freemasons were one of the kinds of mutual societies, but there are all kinds of things. The Odd Fellows, I love that name. There were all kinds of things, and not all of them had sort of the Masonry theology, because Masonry actually, I did a little course on it, attended a little course on it.
It's not even that secret, is it, the Masons?
No, you can get
Everyone
this
Everyone knows
stuff
what the building is in London. Anyone can sign up to it.
Yeah.
It's not that secret.
Not
these days. Anyway.
And when you dig into the ideas, as a Christian, I don't approve of them. I mean, they're wrong, theologically.
Sure.
So yes, I share at least some of that animus. Having said that, some men joined the Freemasons because it was a good mutual aid society that provided those benefits of a mutual aid society, not because they were like, totally committed to the Freemason view of the world.
Mm.
Or, you know what I mean? Mm. So I temper my own hostility to Freemason ideas in regards to the actual organizations. Because
mm.
I think often they were just basically local mutual aid brotherhoods.
Or not necessarily to get too fixated on the Freemasons themselves,
yeah.
but lots and lots of various secret societies, right? The Skull and Bone Society, whatever it is.
Yeah.
The idea that you have what might have started off as a mutual aid society or some sort of brotherhood, but it turns to the dark side one
Maybe
way or
that's
another.
What happens.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I suppose there's no way
I haven't
way
dug into
to...
that aspect okay. of things as much.
All right, fair enough, fair enough. So one of the last things then
yeah.
to ask you about the idea that you, whoever you are out there, could set one up. There's nothing stopping you that you would advocate that then, because, I mean, you started...
Yeah.
You're instrumental, at least, in starting the stuff in the United States. And
that's right.
You think that it's not impossible. It's certainly not crazy.
And certainly, you know, we're legally registered with the state as a nonprofit, right?
Okay.
And each of our chapters is a legally recognized nonprofit organization and so forth. But that's because we kind of knew that we wanted to build this thing up pretty quickly and push hard in this direction to bring the Mutual Aid Society back. But you don't have to start there. Like with basket weaving, literally just start getting together with some friends, bring some other like-minded people together, and start thinking about what can we do now that we have some people who know and trust each other.
It could just be a WhatsApp group, a Facebook group, a Twitter DM group. Just
to start with. Mm. Yeah. But I think the in-person aspect is really key.
Well, that's the key, though, isn't it? That's the whole point of it.
Yeah.
Is that you don't just chat online.
Yeah, yeah.
You physically go somewhere and meet them in real life.
That's right.
And perhaps and do something, even if it's just having a drink.
Yeah. But once you have that, there's so much you...
Right.
So many places you can take it.
Well, that's just the foundation, isn't it?
Yeah.
From there, who knows what you could build.
Beautiful, wonderful things that we need, that our society has lost and is losing, and we need to rebuild. Mm. Right. Mm.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you, Stephen. Thank you very much for talking to me. Fascinating. And I think it's a wonderful thing. It could mean the world of difference for many, many people. It really could.
I hope it does.
So thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. Please do consider liking and subscribing. Until next time then, take care.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That 2-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.